From Pierre Corey's Medical Musings, The Lost Medicine in the Stone, we now arrive at the third and final alchemical text in this series of posts. For those unsettled by this brief foray into the Hermetic canon, take heart. This is the last stop before we turn toward scripture, which, I suspect, will prove to be the deeper well. Before we continue, a brief clarification. Many of the Western alchemists who preserved and worked with these texts, some of whom went on to become founders of modern science, were themselves deeply Christian and saw no contradiction between their faith and the study of nature in this way. They saw Hermes as a symbolic or historical voice rather than a figure of worship, just as I do. They thought of him as one who might preserve observations about creation. Their work, as I see it, was not an attempt to replace God, but to better understand what he had made. If the Emerald Tablet gave the symbolic picture of the cycle on Earth, and the letter from Sternbutsche gave the portrait of the essence brought forth within it, the six keys turns to the work itself, the sequence of openings, dissolutions, and separations through which the essence is brought forth from stone. With that said, let's move forward. These posts have been trying to bring a single structure into view, the recursive, generative process by which mineral chemistry and water produce, sustain, and renew life on Earth. It is the same process that powers biology in all its forms, the same process at work in nature and, when understood, in art. Each text approaches that process from a different angle. In this post, we enter the labyrinth as deeply as we can because the six keys is where the sequence itself is most carefully hidden, the work in art, described in guarded symbolic language. Although presented last in this series, the six keys of Eudoxus proved to be exactly what its title suggests, not just a key, but the key through which the rest of the Hermetic canon began to resolve for me. A brief note on the history of the six keys of Eudoxus. The text appears to date to the late 17th century, and scholars have long noted its resemblance to writings attributed to Irenaeus Philalethes, the alchemical pseudonym widely associated with George Starkey. Starkey was an American born in Bermuda, educated at Harvard, and later active in London in the 1650s. Notably, he was there during the same period as Robert Boyle, of Boyle's Law, one of the founders of modern chemistry, and a central figure in arguing that scientific inquiry and theology were not in conflict but deeply aligned. I bolded that point, given some of the concerns readers have raised about my exploration of alchemical texts. While no definitive attribution can be made, the text most likely emerged from the same Western European alchemical world, carrying the same preoccupation with guarding the method using symbolic compression and deliberate misdirection that defines that period of the Hermetic tradition. What cost me a long time to figure out was that, despite its title, the six keys are not six steps in a procedure. They are instead six symbolic vantage points onto one underlying process, repeating it in shifting language so the reader cannot lock onto it too cleanly. For that reason, I will not walk through all six keys in equal detail. I will begin by moving slowly through the first key, with our role grammar already in place and with a quick review of Shimonishi's method. Shimonishi's process began with vermiculite, a weathered form of biotite, or black mica, an iron-rich mineral known to contain an unusually broad range of elements. In nature, sulfate-bearing rainwater slowly transforms biotite into vermiculite, making it more porous, hydrated, and reactive than its parent stone, whose minerals remain tightly bound within stacked alumina silicate sheets. Shimonishi then dried the vermiculite to remove residual moisture before exposing it to sulfuric acid under carefully controlled conditions, a method that took him nearly 15 years to perfect. The result was a golden-colored, mineral-dense aqueous solution he called Themerox or rock extract. For brevity, I include only the first key below. For the complete document, readers can consult the text here. The first key is that which opens the dark prisons in which the sulfur is shut up. This is it which knows how to extract the seed out of the body, and which forms the stone of the philosophers by the conjunction of the spirit with the body of sulfur with mercury. Hermes has manifestly demonstrated the operation of this first key by these words: in the caverns of the metals there is hidden the stone, which is venerable, bright in color, a mind sublime, and an open sea. This stone has a bright glittering. It contains the spirit of the sublime original. It is the sea of the wise, in which they angle for their mysterious fish. But the operations of the three works have a great deal of analogy one to another, and the philosophers do designedly speak in equivocal terms, to the end that those who have not the lynx's eyes may pursue wrong and be lost in this labyrinth, from whence it is very hard to get out. Take heed, therefore, not to be deceived here, for it is a truth that in each work the wise artist ought to dissolve the body with the spirit. He must cut off the raven's head, whiten the black, and vivify the white. Yet it is properly in the first operation that the wise artist cuts off the head of the black dragon and of the raven. In effect, when one imagines that they speak of one work, they often treat of another. Hence, Hermes says, what is born of the crow is the beginning of this art. Consider that it is by separation of the black, foul, and stinking fume of the blackest black that our astral, white, and resplendent stone is formed, which contains in its veins the blood of the pelican. It is at this first purification of the stone, and at this shining whiteness, that the work of the first key is ended. Recall that in chapters Roman 3 and Roman 4, I introduced the core scientific insights into iron, sulfur, aluminum, water, isochemistry, the chemistry that powers the rock water circuit. That framework describes a planetary energy system that is self-renewing, a process that generates, sustains, and continually recreates the conditions for life. It was a detailed understanding of that chemistry and how it cycles through the earth that allowed us to construct an interpretive key for decoding these texts. To interpret the six keys, one crucial aspect of the relationship between the two mineral forms at the center of the rock water circuit must be understood. Only nature can transform biotite into vermiculite over geologic time. No human can. It is only after that transformation, after black mica has been weathered into vermiculite, that the broad range of minerals it contains can be released. If an alchemist referred to in the text as a philosopher began the work with black mica itself, he would never succeed. That point matters because, across centuries of hermetic alchemy, no universally recognized instance of the substance described in the six keys or letter from Sternbuche has ever been established. To wit, the first key begins with a brazen deception in the first line. The first key is that which opens the dark prisons in which the sulfur is shut up. Here, the text suggests that the alchemist should aim to open black mica, the dark prisons, in order to access the reactive, redox-capable inner alchemistry locked inside the sulfur. But that first opening is humanly impossible. It is my belief that this failure was not accidental, but the result of deliberate misdirection in the six keys. This text cost me months because it appears simple, but it defeats anyone who reads it as such. It belongs to nature alone. This stone has a bright glittering. At first glance, this line seems to point toward a lustrous mineral, something like black mica with its characteristic shimmer. But that reading does not hold. See,